Welcome, everyone, to Michigan Writers on the Air, a program about writers, writing, reading, and listening here in Northwest Lower Michigan. I'm Aaron Stander. During the next hour, I will chat with Doug Stanton about his extraordinary new book, Horse Soldiers. And then nature writer Bob Butts will be stopping by to talk about and read from his book of essays, An Uncrowded Place. It's with great pleasure that I welcome Doug Stanton to Michigan Writers on the Air. Doug Stanton is the author of the New York Times bestseller In Harm's Way and a contributing editor to Men's Journal. Over the years, he has written extensively on travel, sport, entertainment, and history. Doug is also one of the co-founders of the Traverse City Film Festival, an event that has quickly become one of the major film festivals in the country. He's here today to talk about his new book, Horse Soldiers, the extraordinary story of a band of U.S. soldiers who rode to victory in Afghanistan. Welcome, Doug.
Hi, thank you.
And we'll open with Doug reading from that extraordinary book. Go ahead, Doug.
I'm about to read, Aaron, a section from the book, which are these guys who have left Kentucky secretly in October of 2001 have arrived.
Special forces.
Right, just 12 of them. We don't know that they're there back in the States. They don't know exactly what it is they're going to do, but their mission is to simply kick the Taliban out of Afghanistan and make the country unsafe for Al-Qaeda elements as well. And these training camps in Afghanistan had sponsored the 9/11 terrorists. They're told before they leave that they may not come back from this mission. It could be a suicide mission. They're so ill-prepared to actually plan and train and equip themselves that many of the guys that I met and interviewed ended up going to the local mall near Clarksville, Tennessee, and buying all the batteries they could from the battery store. They got online and bought all the GPSs they could from L.L. Bean or REI. And they bought their own hiking boots online. It's truly a homegrown kind of effort. This is, however, America's
elite,
but it's America's answer to 9/11.
Yeah.
So they've arrived, and only one of them knows how to ride a horse. His name is Captain Mitch Nelson. He's from Kansas. The other guys hadn't ridden since they were in high school or as kids. And they discover that the only way they can make it through the countryside is by being on a horse, while the Taliban, who outnumber them, say 40 to 50 to 1, have tanks and vehicles and so on. So our American friends here are actually the insurgents. They're actually the underdog. They're actually aligning themselves with these other Afghans who are trying to overthrow the Taliban in the country, whom the locals do not like. And it turns out later in the story that the Americans, when they come into Kabul and come into Maz-e-Sharif, which is in the book, they're welcomed as liberators and sincerely liked by everybody.
And the horses they're asked to ride are small Afghan horses.
Very small.
And the saddles.
The saddles are not our kinds of saddles. These are 200-pound-plus men sitting on smaller horses made for a man who's 140 pounds. The stirrups can't be adjusted. It's excruciating to be on these animals. And they're walking up 2,000 to 3,000-foot precipices on narrow 2,000 to 3,000-foot-wide trails, literally not knowing where they're going or if the horse is going to walk off the cliff, but they realize quickly that these horses have done this a lot. But they've gone back. As one of the guys told me in the book, Ben Milo, that it's a bit like the Jetsons meet the Flintstones. And so here they are making a horse charge, the first cavalry charge of the 21st century. Our Afghan allies and these 12 American soldiers are about to charge a Taliban line, which is heavily fortified with tanks and artillery. And the Americans can't believe it. Dostum, the warlord who America aligned itself with, wants to wait until dusk or close to it to start the charge. And Mitch says, why? And he says, well, because then we will attack into the darkness. So he's actually using some very ancient kind of thinking. It's very primitive. At the same time, the guys are armed with lasers and fancy radios. So they are quickly adapting to these circumstances, and I'm about to read a section now when this first charge launches. Dostum was yelling in Uzbek. The radio buzzed with anxious voices. Half the men had mounted their horses and ridden them in a line a quarter mile long on the backside of the hill. They were still hidden from the Taliban. It took at least a half hour for all the horsemen to align themselves properly, about 150 of them. They sat on their horses, lifting their calloused, scarred hands to their mouths and speaking into their walkie-talkies, with more men joining the line and then being told to ride out and wait behind the screening hill to form the second wave. It was thrilling. "Charge!" Dostum shouted into the radio. At this, the men bolted. They shot up in their saddles, climbing the backside of the hill, and crested it and let out a yell, and then dropped down and disappeared, at least from the Taliban soldiers' view. Nelson could watch it all in profile from the side. Dostum was beside him, nervously muttering and speaking into the radio and ordering further corrections in the flying mass of thunderous horses and shouting men. There was about a mile of ground between them and the Taliban line, a hell of a distance to cover, Nelson thought, without getting shot. What he saw as he looked at the plain was a series of seven bare ridges between 50 and 100 feet high, with about 200 yards of bare ground separating most of them. Calm water between tall waves. As they rode, the horsemen continued rising up and down the hills, disappearing and appearing. When they got about halfway across the field, the Taliban guns opened up. The noise was deafening, shells and bullets whistling over the ground at head height. Men would be riding in the saddle and then suddenly fly backward as if yanked and tumbled to the ground and lie motionless as more horses approached from behind and leaped over them, charging toward the firing line. Sometimes a wounded man got up and limped away or held out a hand and swung up into the saddle of a fighter smashing past at full gallop. The riders leaned out over the stretched necks of the horses, firing as they ran, the long dark reins clamped in their teeth. The last four ridges comprised a half-mile stretch of the battlefield with maybe as much as 1,000 feet of open ground between some of the ridges. The Taliban tanks sat squat and black, belching thick yarns of smoke on the last ridge. Nelson could see the Taliban raising and lowering the tank's barrels, trying to adjust the fire. It was hard, impossible, as the horsemen swarmed toward them. They were moving fast, growing larger and larger from the Taliban point of view as they approached. As they reached the second-to-last ridge, the riders halted and jumped down from their horses. They threw the reins on the ground, stood on them, lifted their rifles, and began firing methodically at the Taliban line. Some of them were frightened and sprayed the line at full auto. Others shouldered RPGs and fired. Smoke trails whizzed over the open ground as the flying grenades exploded among the Taliban. As they did this, the second wave of horsemen advanced under the covering fire. They were riding hard from behind and overtook the men on the ground and blew past, shouting, galloping straight at the Taliban. The standing fighters swung back into their saddles and beat their horses to catch up, and the two waves joined in one line as they drew near, within shouting distance of the Taliban. Standing near Dostum, Fakir, one of Dostum's aides, was listening to his radio, tuned to the Taliban frequency. He could hear them yelling, "We can't resist, we have to move." As the horsemen charged, many of the Taliban stood up and looked behind them, and then at the horsemen, and then they threw down their weapons and started running, their black smocks flapping, the men slipping on rocks in their cracked dress shoes, falling and rising quickly as the horsemen thudded behind them. The horsemen leaned from the saddle to reach out and club them with their rifles and dismounted to finish them off with their knives, or they shot them, the Taliban throwing their arms wide, turbans unraveling as they fell face first in the hard orange dirt. The fight raged as the light failed, the moon coming up. Just before dark, Nelson spotted a bimpy in a tank still untouched.
Gripping story. The whole book is that gripping. And that was one of the first things I wanted to talk to you about. This is a true story, but it reads like fiction. There is so much tension throughout it, and you never know, the reader never knows what's going to happen. How did you achieve that?
How did I achieve the storytelling effect?
Yes, because you started with the accounts of people who were there.
Mm-hmm.
How did you weave this so beautifully into this tension-filled story?
Well,
and maybe you should even go back and talk about the research that led to this.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, I didn't write any nonfiction until I wanted to start making a living as a writer. When I graduated from the Writers' Workshop at the University of Iowa, it was in poetry. Mm-hmm. In fact, I hadn't even written any prose. And then I got a job at Esquire, which was my very first job as a nonfiction writer, and I had to ask my wife, Ann Stanton, how to actually do any of the interviews. I literally had never done an interview. But I did believe that nonfiction is like fiction in that if you interview enough people and if you absorb enough of the secondary research and you ask enough questions, that it's impossible for any subject not to reveal itself. Mm-hmm. And then it seems to be my job, having done that, to really put myself in the shoes of, say, there's a character in here, a good friend, whose name is Cal Spencer. Mm-hmm. So I look at the world through Cal's eyes. I say, Cal, so what did you eat? What were you thinking? Do you remember what you dreamed the night you woke up before the attack? Do you know what your wife was doing back in Kentucky? Can I talk to her? Yes, you can talk to her, Doug. That's fine. So I call her. I ask her, what were you thinking when you thought that Cal was overseas doing what he was doing? I did over 100 interviews and probably 20 to 30,000 transcript pages of interviews. And all my interviews start with the same question and they end with the same question. They're all chronological. And then what I do is I disassemble them so that I know what everyone is doing at the same moment. It make a
sort of a timeline with everything
right.
in it.
I started doing that about 10 years ago with magazine. I would do profiles of, say, Harrison Ford or George Clooney or Clint Eastwood for Esquire or Men's Journal or whatever. And I discovered that if I didn't break down their life into discrete units and into important moments, plot points, that I wouldn't know how to write about them. So I just kind of appropriated that for this larger canvas. I think of myself as a storyteller, not necessarily a historian. And I think there is a good deal of history in this book, and I wanted the reader to absorb it and kind of digest it without understanding that what they're really reading about is a very radical treatise on a certain kind of doctrine.
Well, and that's another whole part that comes into it, because you provide the reader with enough background, historical, about weaponry, whatever the topic happens to be, that, and you do this very seamlessly so that the reader can organize this. We mm-hmm. understand where you are, where you're going, mm-hmm. which just had to take so much time and attention.
It takes a lot of time. I set out to, and I wrote In Harm's Way, and I really, that book.
Your first book.
Right.
In Harm's Way, you wrote in how many years?
I wrote that in a year and a half.
Year and a half.
This book took 6 years.
Okay.
In Harm's Way was an amazing experience. It meant a lot to me. It changed my life. It changed my life as a storyteller, because I'd written a lot of articles in National Magazine, and none of them seemed to stick, because they're more ephemeral.
Yes.
But that book actually had an impact within Congress and the Department of Navy as pertaining to the captain of that ship, mm-hmm. in Indianapolis, who was court-martialed, et cetera. This is my sophomore book, and I said, this time I want to write a bigger book with more characters, and it's about Afghanistan, so I want to have the Afghanistan point of view. I want to know everything there is to know about all these people, because they're real living people. Mm-hmm. And create and put together in the way you see in Lawrence of Arabia some of those big coverage shots and then zoom down to O'Toole's face and then
yes.
pull back to the battle scenes. I want to see if I can do that as a writer. I've been at this a while now, like for 15 years. Have I learned enough to really do it? And so I set this challenge. I mean, I don't know if it means anything to the reader, but I guess a writer sets up these little bars to leap over as you progress in your career. And I think in this case I achieved it. I mean, I don't know, you've read it. And
yeah, it's a book I couldn't put down, and I think you very much achieved that. I mean, you can see the panorama, and then you cut to the individual soldier or two, and then
right.
you move back. I thought it worked very well.
This scene I just read about the charge, I'd been thinking about it for a long time, and I interviewed, most of the Americans who were there who witnessed it, and then read enough accounts by the Afghans who took part in it and so on. And I started, sometimes when I write, if you think too much about a scene, you can't write it because you start to get in your own way.
Yeah.
And I said, well, I'm preparing to write this scene. I better really prepare and steel myself for it. And then one day I just sat down and wrote it. And in the middle, though, I stopped and I came home for lunch. And I said, well, I wonder what Tolstoy would do. So I just opened War and Peace because that's a book about huge battles, mm-hmm. a very intimate portrait of, you know, the
individuals.
Human psyche. And you know, I think just mechanically, there's a certain way you learn to haul the machinery around the page so that you can do it. And then I realized that really there is no secret except that you see the whole through the one. That is, you see the macro mm-hmm.
yeah.
through one or two sets of eyes. And it's a matter of point of view. So it was exciting to write that scene. It was, you know, because there's a lot going on. And as they're moving across the plain, and I wanted, you know, just to, I wanted the reader to really experience the fact that these guys who had just been in the drive-thru lane at Burger King 2 weeks before back in Kentucky, you know, and these are people who get up in their homes every morning and go to work like you and I, except their job is to actually train to go off to faraway lands and maybe not come home.
And no one had called on them recently.
No.
That was sort of an interesting aspect for me because they had families and...
They had a life.
And a job.
And they're
a
older,
life.
Too.
Yeah.
United States Army Special Forces have been around since World War II. They're really they split off from the OSS, and part of the OSS became the CIA, and part became the Special Forces. These guys are trained to actually be the other in anthropological terms. They're trained mm-hmm. to be diplomats, anthropologists, sociologists. In fact, I was talking to their former commanding general, Major General Jeffrey Lambert, who's down in Florida, and Men's Journal had called me, for whom I write, and said, who's the smartest guy in the Army? They thought maybe I would do some kind of essay. So I called up Lambert, and he said, here's the anecdote which explains who these Special Forces guys are in Horse Soldiers. He said, I have a friend who was in Panama. I don't know when this took place. But he walks into a guerrilla camp, unarmed, which is a hostile camp. Mm-hmm. He says hello, and he convinces everyone around the campfire to surrender to him. He's unarmed. Mm-hmm. And then he convinces them that he would like them to drive them in their van up the mountain to meet their commander, which they do, and he walks into the commander's house unarmed, and he convinces the commander to surrender. Not a shot has been fired, mm-hmm. and he's probably having cocktails for the rest of his life on this. Mm-hmm. But how does a guy do that? There's almost a kind of, it's almost like being a Jedi. What it means is that you are so smart and so empathic and so in tune with the society, the culture, the language, the customs, that when you walk into that campfire, you are the man of the moment, and you know what levers to push, what to say, and you know how to bend the will of those people towards a certain direction. Hopefully that direction is toward the good. That's what these guys are trained to do, and they fight. And that's actually the tenet of guerrilla war. You fight with very little, but you use unconventional tactics.
You know, and that's one of the things that you address in the book, how highly educated and trained these mm-hmm. people are. And in some ways, they knew more about what was going on in Afghanistan than the policymakers in Washington.
Right. One of my people I interviewed and have since become friends with, Dean Nosorog, in the book, spoke the languages. He was keeping a pie chart of what was going on in Afghanistan prior to 9/11. Mm-hmm. Because he'd been in Uzbekistan, and the IMU, which is an Islamic group up there, a radical one, he thought was going to cause some trouble. And when it happened, he was completely prepared. He'd been thinking, I know what I could do here. I know who the players are, and their job is to be dropped off secretly, kind of in a very low impact, light footprint kind of way, and they walk into the guerrilla camp. And they try to be accepted, and then they bring whatever it is they have in their bag of tricks and add it to the locals' own fight against the ruling class. And again, in this Afghanistan, and still today in 2009, the ruling class is the Taliban or mm-hmm. Al-Qaeda. And then they start to work against them. So, you know, Dean, but here's Dean's problem. When he asked for intel for his pre-insertion briefing, one day the guy knocks on the door and he drops off a box of VHS tapes from the Discovery Channel. Mm-hmm. And Dean goes, what's that? And he goes, well, buddy, that's your intel. This is your preparation for going in Afghanistan. He goes, you got to be kidding me. He says, no, there is no plan to invade Afghanistan. So they expected Dean would watch a bunch of Discovery Channel TV shows to figure out what's going on in Afghanistan today. And then they dropped off National Geographics. And at one point, they even sent him a fax of Mohammed Atta, one of the 9/11 hijackers, yes, whom the own intelligence people had confused with Atta Mohammed, who is the, quote, good guy that Dean was supposed to mm-hmm. link up with and meet. So he realized that we were all woefully underprepared to do this, but yet that actually is – those kind of odds are what they enjoy. So this is not the regular army. It's a very different branch of the army.
Very mature, very highly educated, mm-hmm. Which comes through in the text. So 9/11 happened in your own life. 9/11 happened – in harm's way, was done and out. Were you looking for a new project? How did you get into this project?
Well, when that September, I was actually still on book tour. In fact, I was supposed to go to New Orleans to the D-Day Museum and do a talk in October, and it was canceled. And then the trade paper came out in 2002, and I actually did more book touring for that. And one of the climaxes of the book is November 25th, 2001. There's a big battle where John Walker Lind is discovered.
Yes, yep.
And these guys are involved in that discovery and the unfortunate death of a CIA officer named Mike Spann,
yes,
as well, involved in that. Alex Perry, a reporter for Time magazine, happened to be in the fortress during this battle, and he wrote an amazing account that Time published, I think, in December 2001. I clipped it. Or actually, Anne, my wife, clipped it and said, this is really interesting. And it was around 2002 that I actually went to reading it, and because I started to think, what would I do next? At one point, I thought I'd do a trilogy of these kinds of books. It happened to be World War II, and then it would be this more modern conflict. And then I think also that the Vietnam War is ready for a revisit because those veterans are now reaching the age that the original World War II veterans were when they began the talk.
But, yes.
So anyway, I came to this and I said, maybe I can approach the modern soldier in the way that I had done with the World War II veteran, not realizing that it was a completely different set of challenges.
The interesting part, there are so many interesting parts of the story, but I want to go back to something. There were 12 men with a lot of support, mm-hmm. a lot of air support. And they managed to help overrun a country.
Mm-hmm.
What can we learn from this? Because we know that in Afghanistan, the British were defeated. I mean, we can go through history.
Mm-hmm.
The Russians were defeated. But with 12 Americans aligning themselves with the Northern Alliance,
mm-hmm.
We were able to come to some kind of victory. Now, Al-Qaeda is still alive and well there. We are pouring troops in.
Mm-hmm.
The president and Congress are struggling with what to do so that this doesn't become another Vietnam. What can be learned from your book, do you think?
I think that the drama as it's portrayed in Horse Soldiers is that it's a template for the way you can resolve this conflict in Afghanistan and the way you can approach other conflicts around the globe, in which that military conflicts are really political battles. I mean, ultimately, the goal of war is to drive the enemy to the bargaining table, or into the grave.
Mm-hmm.
If we can figure out as human beings to skip that middle part, which involves the shooting and the bombing,
mm-hmm.
then we get right to the table. And what these guys did, and what they're trained to do, and what they've done throughout history is they approach this as a systemic problem. So when they meet Dostum, Captain Mitch Nelson says,
Who is, you might want to elaborate on him because he's an incredible character.
Yeah, he's our guy with his own set of baggage in Afghanistan.
And how many years had he been fighting sort of continuously?
Well, since the Soviets invaded in 1979 and left in 89, I mean, Dostum fought with the Soviets, and then he fought against the Soviets, and then he aligned himself with Ahmad Shah Massoud, who was assassinated on September 9th, 2001, as a kickoff to September 11th. He was mm-hmm. a great anti-Taliban leader of the Afghan people. So Dostum is a man with whom you can make deals.
Yeah.
And so he actually made him a very apt ally in this case because he brought his certain people to the battlefield, and a more teetotaling, pious warlord named Atta Muhammad, whom Dean Nosorog in the book worked with, comes to the table. But Atta and Dostum don't like each other. And in fact, shortly after the book ends in 2000, they're fighting each other in the streets of Mazar-e-Sharif. So what these guys did in Horse Soldiers is they figured out how do you point Dostum and Atta in the same direction, make them stop fighting each other because they have a common good that they're in search of, and go after the real problem, which is the Taliban. The Taliban having filled the vacuum in that country, which was created by 15-plus years of civil war. By the time the locals had realized who the Taliban were, it was too late because they did welcome them into the Kabul because they did restore order and peace. So they care for, you know, the tyrant's curse. So what did they do in the book? They went in and they were very careful and thoughtful. At the simplest level, Brett Walden, who later tragically lost his life in Iraq. One day he's walking down the street. He's a rather handsome fellow, and he notices that the Afghan women are lifting their burqas and winking at him. Now, Brett's not a 21-year-old kid out of high school. He's an older, seasoned Special Forces soldier, and he thinks this could be an international incident. I mean, that's not the first stop.
Exactly.
Most American men are going to have when they've been away from their homes for a good. And so he realizes that he quickly has to stop this. But that, I mean, it goes from that small of that sense of nuance that this is not my country. This is their country. And when I leave, it's still going to be their country. Yeah. And I'm here to simply help them do what it is they want to do. And hopefully that's also what America wants to happen.
The great battle in the book, at the end of the book, is where John Walker Lind, the American Taliban, which the headlines screamed for days. Do you want to talk about that a bit? Because there is no other account that really, I think, gives people exactly who this kid was and how he ended up there. And the fact that he survived that particular event is just miraculous.
Well, yeah, his saga points to the randomness of war. I mean, he did survive. He comes from Marin, California. He goes to Yemen at a young age to study Arabic. And one thing led to one ill-informed decision after another leads him to...
I mean, it's like, don't let your 18-year-old sons out to wander the world.
Exactly.
In a way.
Right. Well, don't send them to Yemen on spring break.
Exactly.
Without realizing that, you know, the USS Cole is being targeted there by Islamic radicals. So... Lind is so interesting. My editor, Colin Harrison at Scribner, you know, what happens to John Walker Lind in this book? Because he does leave California, and we do find him at the end of the book in this fortress, Kuala Jangi, where this gigantic battle takes place, which is different than the horse charges.
Yeah. There is one point after another in the book just filled with tension, and that's sort of the closing battle scene, but it's still a very dramatic scene.
Right. Well, Colin at Scribner said, well, if Norman Mailer were writing this book, actually Lind would be the protagonist because he's kind of our meta character. He's our 21st century character because he's a young man who's filled with the hubris of being an American. That is, if I leave home and go somewhere else in the globe, I'll be okay. It'll be just like being back at home. Mm-hmm. The globe doesn't work that way. But most people with good intentions somehow are lulled into thinking that it's all might going to work out just fine. So he sits at home on the computer and researches Islam and being a Muslim and but everything he knows is basically come from a set of pixels on a computer screen. It's unbelievable to me, but he really doesn't grasp apparently that the Taliban are stoning women, they're amputating men in a soccer stadium for thievery, you know, they're executing people in broad daylight for entertainment and punishment. I mean, these are not nice people. They're misanthropic.
Yes.
They're filled with hubris. And but Lind is not aware of this, he says, and I actually can believe it because if you approach the world of ideas through something like the internet, you only really find what you're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's one of the problems with doing research on the web, because everything narrows itself down to your own interests.
Yes.
Have it your way, you know, and that's not exactly the way the rest of the globe works. So anyway, he decided, you know, because he can't speak Persian, they throw him in with the Arabic speakers, which he does speak, and those Arabic speakers happen to be part of bin Laden's Al-Ansar Brigade. Not that he wants to be a crack terrorist, but that's where he can get along. And
yeah.
So he ends up finally in his trench in Afghanistan realizing that I'm stuck. Because if I now stand up and tell these guys, you know what, I think I'm out of here.
You're dead.
Yeah. What it is that he realized that I think that people are willing to pay him blood for these ideas that he had researched on the computer.
Mm-hmm. And just an incredible story. Do you want to take, in the closing couple of minutes we have, do you want to talk about that final battle?
The book begins on September 10th in the homes and living rooms of these guys who don't know they're about to embark on this historic journey and battle. And then it ends in Afghanistan in this mud fortress that looks like it's from the Arabian Nights, called the House of War, or in Persian, Khwala Jangi.
Mm-hmm.
In a classic kind of epic Trojan horse move, the Taliban have decided that the only way to recapture the city that they've just been kicked out of, they're going to drive back to it and surrender at the gates and ask to be taken prisoner,
mm-hmm.
which is, well, sounds unbelievable to us. In fact, in that culture, it happens all the time. In a society without a lot of resources and jails, if you surrender and give up, now you're on my team and,
mm-hmm.
and you're just with me because I can't have anything else to do with you. I can't, you know, I'm not going to incarcerate you.
And because of cultural taboos, no one gets searched.
They're very lightly searched because exactly, and so they're stored in the southern end of Khwala Jangi Fortress, which happens to also be the storeroom for thousands of weapons the Taliban had cached there during the occupation of that city. They're being questioned by two CIA officers on the morning of November 25th, 2001. And at some point during that interrogation, an Uzbeki prisoner jumps up and starts a riot. And within minutes, the guys I talked to who witnessed this, all the guards were dead. The Taliban had picked up the weapons and they started firing. Unfortunately, just hours before, the bulk of the American presence had left Mazar-e-Sharif and this fortress and gone to another city where they thought the real war was about to happen. There are only about 8 to 12 Americans left to defend this fort, which is now filled with about 600 very angry, committed Taliban and al-Qaeda fighters. So the last third of the book is about how, at that time, Major Mark Mitchell from Milwaukee tries to put this fighting down, and because if they lose this city, they really will lose the north of Afghanistan, at least for a while, and thereby the whole country. Because what we didn't say at the beginning was that their battle was, if they didn't succeed, this Afghan thing may have gone wrong for the entire winter and then mm-hmm. maybe beyond.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, it's actually urban combat. And Mark ends up being awarded the Distinguished Service Cross for what happened there. Which is the highest award,
yes.
Except the Medal of Honor. And they do survive and they do succeed, but the prisoners did not want to be taken alive. It was they were kind of shocked by the vehemence with which they fought back. And once they broke into these weapons closets and cabinets that they found in this part of the courtyard, it was all over.
Mm-hmm. It's an incredible story. I recommend it to everyone. Can I be the first to say this is going to be another New York Times bestseller?
Or has someone
beat me to
no,
it? The book is Horse Soldiers, The Extraordinary Story of a Band of U.S. Soldiers Who Rode to Victory in Afghanistan. Doug Stanton, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Aaron.
I know the book will do very well.
Thank you.
You're listening to Michigan Writers on the Air on IPR News Radio. I'm pleased to welcome Bob Butts to Michigan Writers on the Air. Bob is a freelance writer. His work has appeared in Sports Afield, The New York Times, GQ, National Wildlife, Outdoor Life, Men's Journal, and Field and Stream, to name a few. His articles and essays usually deal with fishing, hunting, and environmental issues. He's here today to talk about his new book of essays, An Uncrowded Place, The Delights and Dilemmas of Life Up North, and A Young Man's Search for Home. Ah, how do you like that?
Very good. Thank you.
Glad to see you, Bob.
Thank you.
And we should talk about the book a little bit. It's a collection of, as I counted them, what, 30?
I think about 40.
About 40 essays.
Short vignettes and essays.
Yeah, 2 to 3 pages. Just a very comfortable mm-hmm. read.
Mm-hmm.
And the first one sort of sets the tone for the entire volume.
Sure.
And I imagine you selected that on purpose.
I tried, yeah.
So if you would start by reading that.
This one's called Up North. Let's take a moment to orient ourselves. The place we're headed is north. Just follow the ducks and skeins of geese heading home. Or easier still, simply pile into something with four-wheel drive and follow the highway signs, the odd-numbered ones, up into the tall timbered hills and deep piney forests, rippling up from the flat farm country, cities, suburbs down below. Go until the hard top ends in the territory near or beyond the 45th parallel, just this side of Canada. The question at hand is not so much how to find your way north, but rather how to know when you've finally arrived. Like the Deep South, it's a region within itself that's hard to pinpoint on a map. Latitude is our Mason-Dixon line, but it's an arbitrary boundary. Better to watch for those hand-painted road signs advertising apple cider and maple syrup for sale, beef jerky, smoked whitefish, and you pick blueberries. Good luck, deer hunters! Look for pine and cedar trees, aspen and white birch. Here, real men love Jesus, and the ravens in the sky outnumber the crows. I'm writing from up in Michigan, my little corner of the north, home to Paul Bunyan and Babe the Blue Ox, Hemingway's Nick Adams, Longfellow's Hiawatha, and the big lake called Gitche-Gumee. Here, all the rivers and streams run cold. Everybody owns a trout rod, a pair of skis or snowshoes, and at least one canoe. It's a country located in the upper Midwest, a place of mystery and myth that is shaped, fittingly, I think, like the back of your left hand. In fact, if you're ever up this way and stop to ask directions, the folks up here are liable to show you where you're going by drawing it out on the back of their hand. If you've always lived here, it probably doesn't seem like such an odd thing. But I'm from another place, so it just strikes me as quaint how whenever anybody wants to tell me where they're from or where they're going, they hold up their left hand and point to a spot on it. There's an old saying about being able to tell a lot about a person by looking at their hands. That's as true in Michigan, maybe more so than anywhere else. I'm learning that there's something comforting in that, being able to find your place in this world through something as simple as looking at your hands. Traverse City, it's exactly on the end of your pinky.
Aha. Uh-huh. You know, and if you hold your other hand up like this, it almost looks like the Upper Peninsula.
It does.
And the Keweenaw is at the top of your thumb.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And if you, the left hand is also shaped like the state of Pennsylvania where I'm actually from. So.
Oh, goodness. Yeah. So we have our 40 essays. How many years does this cover?
That's a hard one. These essays originally came about through a column I used to occasionally contribute to at Traverse Magazine.
Mm-hmm. I remember those well.
And I believe I started them in about 2000, I mm-hmm. believe. And at the time, I really didn't know that I was writing a book. I pretty much just wrote them randomly. But about 10 years, I think. Over the course of those 10 years, I probably wrote 80 essays, but only at the end of it, and did I look and see that 40 of them were worthwhile.
Well, one of the interesting things about those essays is we start with the portrait of an artist as a young man.
Oh, young, struggling man.
A struggling man living in a humble dwelling mm-hmm. With a wood-fired stove.
That didn't work.
That didn't work, and snow blowing in under the door.
Exactly.
And we move from that to a married man and then a man with children. Mm-hmm. It's sort of the course of your life.
Exactly, yeah.
And the essays follow that very nicely. The interesting thing is, you've mentioned you come from Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the essays I liked early on, especially, was the one about the axe.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
You wanted one of those Michigan
double-bitted axes.
Double-bitted axes. Mm-hmm. What, growing up in an urban environment, what attracted you in this direction? Because it seems like it was predestined almost.
I don't know. My father died when I was quite young, and he was always an outdoorsman and very, very into the outdoors. My mother often says that he was a little maniacal about his passion for being outdoors and doing what some might say extreme things outside. He was a young man when he died, and I was only 11. And I think when you lose a parent that young, you sort of, unlike me, my dad was not a writer, left no record for me as to who he was.
Mm-hmm.
And that was always something that was lacking, I think, in my life. And it's probably one of the reasons why I became a writer, was because I didn't want that to happen to my kids if someday I should have them. When a child, I think, loses a parent that young, they still don't lose the desire to know them. And the thing that I knew about my father was that he was extremely into the outdoors, and that's sort of the way I went, and I believe that in a way I got to know him through that. When I was young, my father used to, I read Outdoor Life and Field and Stream like most kids read comic books, because that was a passion of his, and I always had loved that. And the Michigan double-bitted axe, mm-hmm, was the epitome of the mountain man's axe and the symbol of all things outdoors, I believe.
And one of the essays even talks about how you finally acquired that axe.
Yes.
Which, very special.
Yeah, it was sort of a quest. When I moved up here, I thought it would be an easy thing to find. I mean, it's Michigan, but that sort of axe isn't, I guess, used as much as I would like to think that it is these days. And
chainsaws are easy to come
by. Chainsaws are easier to use, and I had quite a time finding one, but I eventually did find one at a hardware store, and I still have it to this day.
And the part of you becoming a writer, what moved you in that direction? As an undergraduate, did you decide to...
Yes, I went to the University of Pittsburgh and spent some time at a branch campus there, the University of Pittsburgh at Johnstown, and I was a creative writing major. I was always into writing. I started writing for money, I guess you'd say, when I was still in college.
Oh, that's extraordinary.
Yeah, well, it wasn't... It was as shocking to me as it is to most people I tell that story to, because
what?
I had
got a check?
I got a check. It was quite shocking, but I decided that I didn't go the typical route in college. I took courses I liked, and I wouldn't declare a major. And for 3 years, I took courses that I enjoyed. And at the end of the 3 years, my guidance counselor at the time called me into his office and said, "Hey, if you want to get out of here next year, you need to declare a major." And I said, "Well, what could I claim as a major with what I got?" And he said, "You could do writing or English." And I said, "Well, I like writing. Sounds like a good idea." And that's what I did.
And according to your essays, you moved from a job where you were a packager of worms.
Yes.
Which is a real specialty, I think.
Oh, it's extremely demanding work. And it's the kind of work that you get when you're a writing major in college. And you think
to be able to count to 12.
Or? Exactly. And you think that you, because you had some success selling some articles to some small newspapers around your small town, that you could make it as a writer. And I decided when I got out of school, I had a very hard time getting a job. I didn't want to move to New York.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't me at the time. And so I was stuck doing menial jobs and writing in a basement apartment that I had with a roommate of mine.
It's called a garden apartment.
Is it?
Yeah. That makes it sound so much better, doesn't it? You're
better.
Looking up at the garden.
I lived in a man named Walter's house in his basement, and it was good, though. I enjoyed it, and it was a good time. But yes, I did work in a bait store, and I didn't like to clerk very much, and I had an aptitude for packing worms and bagging minnows and packing mealworms and those sorts of things.
But your career as a writer sort of took off when you came into this area.
Oh, yeah, maybe.
And, you know, it's interesting. Last year we had Dave Ritchie on the program. Mm-hmm. The outdoor writer, and he said something like, you know, there are all these people that like to have my job because they think all I do is hunt and fish and never really have to do much, and they don't know what it's like to sit down every day and crank out an article.
I found out early on that I could never make it strictly as an outdoor writer.
Yes.
It was very difficult. I was an editor for an outdoor magazine for a couple of years, and I had met a lot of writers who were quote-unquote outdoor writers, and they had many books out and were still having to work a full-time job, and I always wanted to be a working writer. That mm-hmm. was important to me. I wanted to be an artist, but I also wanted to be a working writer. And I figured I need to branch out and do other things, mm-hmm. I've since done those things and continue to do them. But it's a lot more work than I ever thought it would be, but it's satisfying work, and I'm quite blessed. It does allow me to do pretty much what I want with in reason. Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful life, but it is tough.
It's tough. As a freelance writer, would you sort of talk about that? What does it mean to have to generate and market material?
Well,
I mean, people have these real, you know, really romantic ideas that someone will be knocking on your door.
I always feel like when people ask me those questions, I always feel like I'm too much of a realist. My wife tells me that quite often. I think people have their ideas of what it's like, and the ideas most of the time are not based in reality. It's a job where these essays, for instance, this book of essays, An Uncrowded Place, is the fun part of what I do. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things that I write that my name is not attached to. I'm a copywriter. Mm-hmm. I write a lot of marketing material. I do PR work for people. Mm-hmm. I write news releases. I write web copy, things that, and that is, unfortunately, or is the lion's share of what I do. Mm-hmm. But people, they only see the books.
Yes.
And they think it's wonderful, and it is. But it's probably a third of what I do when it comes to writing.
One of your essays that sort of talks about the writing life is Life and Taxes.
Life and Taxes.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if you'd read that for us.
I can try. Life and Taxes. The winter all but passed, and you would think the worst possible part of living up in Michigan was over, but not so fast. It's tax season, a particularly disagreeable time when the government requires an accounting for how you spend your daylight hours. When you're broke, those forms have a way of calling career choices into question, not to mention the fact that the pay scale in northern Michigan is so grossly out of whack with the rest of the country. A friend once said that you don't move to northern Michigan to get ahead in your field. You come here to stand in a field. Ours is a tourist town come summer, a picture postcard community that overlooks a Caribbean blue finger of Lake Michigan, Grand Traverse Bay. Which brings to mind another old saying, a view of the bay is half the pay, if only that miserable old saw were true. There's better opportunity, bigger money elsewhere. Come tax season, that hodgepodge of numbers reckoning income and loss is not only depressing, it also confirms what my wife has been saying all year. But instead of trying to quantify it with pay stubs and receipts, I'd rather we remind ourselves why a life up here is worth living, by taking an inventory of another kind. It's probably a good exercise no matter where you live. Topping my own list are all the obvious things that make the North so appealing to weekend tourists. The intoxicating, wide openness of the country, the sunny beaches and good clean air, and of course, the unhurried pace of life in a small town. I'm proud of the friendships made. Friends naturally become surrogates for family when you're lacking those kinds of ties to the place you live. But then, I also like the people of Northern Michigan in general. What's not to like about folks in the habit of saying excuse me and thank you and how do you do? I like people who look me in the eye when they talk and wave over the steering wheel when crossing paths on a winding country road. I remember that first winter here, how I marveled at how the snow fell and kept falling like nothing I'd ever seen back east. The gas gauge in the truck was on the fritz, and coming home from work one night, I ran the tank dry. I wasn't quite in the middle of nowhere, but close. The wind blew something awful, not merely sheeting the snow sideways, but actually blowing it back up. Now, if you've always lived here, it probably doesn't seem out of the ordinary that somebody stopped to give me a lift. Nor does it probably strike as odd that this person, a young lady with two small children no less, not only waited for me while I sheepishly filled a container with a gallon or two, but also drove me back to my heap of a car, thus seeing to it that I hardly got my loafers wet. Who were these folks, the half dozen or so, who always appeared with jumper cables, shovels, and tow ropes to bail out of the ditch? Me, the same old dope with Pennsylvania plates. I sure wandered. And I also knew I never wanted to live in a place where kindness to strangers is the exception rather than the norm. Give me trout streams, big woods, and towns with Indian names. I need a country wild with wolves and moose and rumors of mountain lions. The kind of place where a young hunter taking his first whitetail buck makes the front page of the local news. Here, the country, not the calendar, tells me when the seasons change. Spring is a warm rain and a wedge of geese heading home. Summer, a sunny day on the beach. Autumn is a harvest moon and leaves the color of fire and sun. Winters are long, gray, snowy, and cold. When work saps everything from you, place has a way of filling you up again. And if you're like me, you need to head outside when in want of a little perspective. So today found me standing alone, waist deep in a river, casting to trout, where the ebb and flow of the current pulled all dismal notions of impending poverty away. Then it began to snow, one of those freak April storms with wafting flakes as big as silver dollars. I held my palm out to catch one, but just like that other sort of wealth, I was surprised to find how quickly this one, too, melted away in my hand.
Oh, thank you. It's a beautiful essay, and it really, really speaks to why we're here. And it was snowing in April. That must have been an oddity that year.
Yeah, it was, but not unusual up here.
Yeah, I watched our lake open up, I think, on Easter Sunday.
Oh, this year I thought it would be until June until we saw the end of the snow.
So your range of topics in this book of essays are so varied. We go from hunting and fishing and where to look for rabbits or quails to battling with squirrels and your neighbors over your bird feeder.
Yeah. Glad we don't have to read that one. You'll have to buy the book to read that one.
That's a great essay. How do you generate these topics?
Oh, I write about things that interest me and things that I think are funny and or things that touch me in some way. This book, I'm very lucky because this book is sort of a, if I were a photographer, I would have taken snapshots of my life up here and I would have put them in this book.
And we should put the title out there again, An Uncrowded Place by Bob Butts.
Yes.
Okay. And what's the process then? Do you keep a journal or does the idea hit you and you just start working on it or?
I take things that I've been thinking about for a while, and I'm not a writer that likes to sit down and just have nothing to write about. I think that's a recipe for writer's block if you don't know what you want to write about. So I tend to think about things long and hard. I write all of the time in my head, mm-hmm. and if an idea sticks with me over the long term, I will sit down and write it. And these essays were almost composed like poems. I would try to work on one a week sometimes and really just try to hone that idea and see where it took me, whatever that idea that led me to sit down. And it usually, like I say, are things that you have ideas all of the time. And we all do as writers, I think. But there's few of them that are really actually good ideas. And I like to percolate on them.
Well, I often think the ideas are good, but when you actually write them out, finished product may not be as good as the idea.
It's like a wonderful dream you had at night, and you think at the time, it's just the funniest thing.
This
is wonderful. And then you get up, and I used to keep a dream journal, and I used to get up in the morning and read the journal, and it was – didn't even know what I was talking about. It was the worst idea that I'd had or something.
So did you ever resolve the squirrel problem with your neighbors?
Yes. That letter in the book is actually real. I actually did put that in their mailbox. And I never heard from them again.
Ever.
Ever. They probably thought I was a little...
Was there a for sale sign on their house soon after
probably
that?
Thought I was a little touched, I think.
So what kind of discipline do you have as a writer to get this done?
Extreme amount. I'm a father of two. I work at home.
Two young
children at home. And I have to, basically my schedule, I start 4:30 each day and have done it for so long. I can't recall the last time I slept in until 6. But I get 3 hours at that point of the morning. The phone is ringing. The children aren't awake. Mm-hmm. And nobody wants a thing from me. And in those 3 hours, I love that time of day. And that is the time when I create things that, for lack of a better term, I would call my artistic mm-hmm. things that I do, be it fiction or essays. Mm-hmm. Or and then the rest of my day is dedicated to, you know, raw carpentry. And,
yes.
You know, just I hammer the nails, I guess, during the rest of the day. And I write throughout the day as well when I can. But I've trained myself to be able to sit down and pretty much write what I need to when I need to, because time is – there's not enough of it.
Well, it's a wonderful collection. It covers such a wide range of topics, including the carpentry on your house and mm-hmm. the idiots who added on.
Joel, well, it was a fun topic.
I think there's
to discuss.
There's something there for everyone. I started reading the book in the middle, and then read it at the back, and then went to the front, and then went through mm-hmm. it, the whole book, and it's just absolutely charming.
There's a lot about the writing life, a lot about my being a father and a stay-at-home dad, and of course there's a lot about the outdoors, which is so important to life up here. And
I think that anyone who loves our region is going to really enjoy this book. Okay. And your website is?
BobButts.com.
Thank you for being here.
Bye-bye. Thank you, sir.
Thank you for joining us this month on Michigan Writers. I want to thank our participants on today's program, Doug Stanton and Bob Butts. I invite you to check the Michigan Writers website at mishwriters.org for an updated list of workshops and activities. My gratitude to our production crew here at IPR Radio, Peter, Jack, Brock, and Linda. Be sure to listen next month to Michigan Writers on IPR News Radio 91.5. The show airs the fourth Saturday of the month at 7 p.m., repeating on Sunday at 1 p.m., Until then, we wish you great writing, great reading, and the best of all words.